Welcome back, everyone. This is the April 2021 edition of JOS Unplugged, the official podcast of the Yellow Journal. I am your host, Corey Smith. I am currently a fifth-year orthopedic resident at Prisma Health in Greenville, South Carolina, and currently the executive chair of the executive committee of the resident assembly within the academy. It is a pleasure to welcome you back again. We want to thank you so much for joining us. I think we have a really cool series of article reviews and a really awesome interview for you this month. We're going to be talking with Dr. Matthew Seminaro, who has a really interesting background in psychology and then found his way into orthopedic surgery. And he and his co-authors wrote a really interesting article in the April 1st edition of the Yellow Journal titled "The Psychological Effects of Musculoskeletal Trauma." So we'll be talking about that today. And I think that is really kind of an issue that's made its way to the forefront as mental health has kind of become more openly discussed in society. And I think in orthopedic surgery as well. And so hopefully you'll give that a listen. Even if you don't take care of musculoskeletal trauma patients, I think that we really talk about the psychological effects of injury as well, and how as orthopedic surgeons, even though we aren't ultimately treating those patients, we can play a role in helping them receive the care they need and identifying them early to prevent bigger events down the road. We're then going to review three articles from the April 1st and April 15th edition of the Yellow Journal. There's an article from the April 1st edition titled "Preoperative Opioid Use Increases the Cost of Care in Total Joint Arthroplasty." We'll then move over to the April 15th edition of the Yellow Journal, where we will review an article titled "Deltoid Ligament Injuries Associated with Ankle Fractures, Arguments For and Against Direct Repair." And then our final article that we'll review will be an article titled "Analysis of Online Reviews of Orthopedic Surgeons and Orthopedic Practices Using Natural Language Processing." So I think it's a really interesting and diverse episode we're going to have for you today. However, before we go any further, as we do every month, we want to remind you that JOS Unplugged is brought to you by Modernizing Medicine. Helping orthopedic practices fight burnout and connect with patients, Modernizing Medicine offers an orthopedic-specific suite of healthcare IT solutions, including the number one ortho-specific EHR system, EMA, as well as practice management, billing services, analytics, patient engagement tools like telehealth, and much more. To see a two-minute demo, visit modmed.com/orthopod. That's modmed.com/orthopod. All right, let's get started. All right. Well, we have a really fantastic interview for you today that I think is a really timely issue and something that I'm really glad we get to discuss today. We're talking about the psychological effects of musculoskeletal trauma with Dr. Matthew Seminaro. He is one of the co-authors who wrote this. I think it's a really interesting article in the April 1st edition of JOS, which we obviously want to point everyone back to the article in the actual journal, as we always do. But Matt, thanks for joining us today, man.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me, Corey.
Absolutely. So, you know, before we go too far, we kind of want to do what we always do and give you a chance to kind of introduce yourself to the listeners, let them know your background and kind of where you're at and your training, and kind of introduce yourself a little bit.
Yeah, thanks so much. My name is Matthew Seminaro. I'm currently in my last few months of training at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. Next year, I'll be attending UC San Francisco for my orthopedic trauma fellowship. And really, my interest in psychology and how it pertains to medicine started a long time ago. I was raised in Miami by two lovely parents who happened to both be psychologists. So you can already guess why I might have pursued writing this review article. And my father, he specializes in post-traumatic stress, stress management, crisis intervention, and various cognitive behavioral therapies. And he also played an integral role in the inspiration for this paper. And I left Miami a few hours north to University of Florida, where I received my pre-med training and a bachelor's degree in psychology. And then I found while I was traveling and doing my fellowship interviews for trauma, I expressed my interest in psychology and how it pertains to the orthopedic trauma field. And after interviewing with Denver Health, Dr. Moffrey reached out to me to collaborate on a review article. And then his colleague, Dr. Perry, joined the team, as well as my mentor, Dr. Kang at Maimonides, who's also an orthopedic traumatologist.
Fantastic. That is so cool. I think that this is something that it really takes somebody who has kind of that background to want to approach it, because I don't think it's something that naturally in our orthopedic training always comes to light. So,
so very cool that you come with that psychology background. As you address in the paper multiple times, I think it's a really important thing, not just for psychological and psychiatric outcomes of our patients, but also for orthopedic outcomes. We obviously know how your background kind of led to this paper being written, but just wondering, are there any like personal anecdotes or something that popped up in your training that kind of led you to wanting to look more into the psychological effect of musculoskeletal trauma specifically?
I think probably more than anything, it's just a bit of a general appreciation that I've gained, I guess, through my upbringing and my undergraduate training to see how to, you know, treat the patient as a whole and a little bit less focused on solely their physical injury. In general, undergoing any surgery is a stressful experience with varying degrees of impact, regardless of someone's coping skills, whether it be an elective upper extremity surgery or a total joint replacement. I just felt it was important to focus on orthopedic trauma due to the inherent unpredictable nature of trauma, its ability to uproot and derail a totally normal life, which is grounds for major psychological impact from a functional standpoint, an economic standpoint, a cognitive standpoint. And then I think secondly, you know, we keep seeing the results in the literature for decades regarding, as the LEAP trial points out, the biopsychosocial impact that trauma has on patients. And we see on studies of calcaneus fractures, Lisk fractures, pilon fractures, how these poor outcomes are largely based on socioeconomic differences rather than perhaps, you know, radiographic outcomes. So as we see highlighted in this article, there's a plethora of newer papers demonstrating poor outcomes based on psychological metrics. So while reviewing this topic, at the end of all these papers I was reading, I noticed the same conclusion. We see that there's a problem and that further studies need to be done to find out how to fix it. And so the goal of this paper isn't really necessarily to fix it right away, but it's to review the literature, offer some suggestions on how to start fixing it, and mostly bring awareness to the community.
I really like how you said uproot and derail. I think that we sometimes get so focused, specifically in trauma, on the x-rays, right, and the soft tissue management. And, you know, you forget, as you said, that we're treating a person as well. And there's obviously, you know, lifelong impact that this trauma can have. So I think you say it nicely that it not only, you know, as we know now, I think, which is a newer thing that's come to light, that it can affect their orthopedic outcome, but just the outcome of their life in general can be gravely affected by the psychosocial impact of these traumas. So let's just jump right into it. You mentioned the kind of newer wave of studies that look at this psychosocial impact that you guys dove into. If you could just talk to us a little bit about what you found as far as the prevalence of, you know, how common these psychosocial issues are after trauma and who it affects. I know you said that socioeconomic factors play a big role, but kind of who we see it affecting more disproportionately and kind of how these things present.
Sure, certainly. And maybe just to backtrack even one step, interestingly, right around the time that this paper was finished and submitted pending review, the clinical practice guidelines by the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons were published from the Metric Consortium. And they titled it Evaluation of Psychosocial Factors Influencing Recovery from Adult Orthopedic Trauma, which was nice for two reasons. I mean, one, it reinforced the traction this topic has gained and kind of the growing awareness from the orthopedic community. But then secondly, if you look through their outline, they came up with a similar workflow to ours, which was reinforcing for me since in a way this very large influential consortium of, you know, talented surgeons unknowingly agreed with my outline. So for anyone that found interest in this paper, you should go over and check out their evidence-based clinical practice guidelines. But basically what they came to was a moderate recommendation for clinicians to evaluate anxiety, PTSD, depression, premorbid psychiatric conditions, smoking, lower education level, less social support, and then resilience issues. So a lot of the things that we go on to talk about. And then to answer your question regarding prevalence, so that's kind of what the introduction of this paper goes into, looking at some of the epidemiological outcomes and all of the various things that we go through, anxiety, depression, PTSD, et cetera. And basically, a lot of the numbers are up to half of patients, essentially, on average, regardless of which metric we're looking at, whether it's anxiety, depression, PTSD, go on to develop some form of psychological condition after sustaining an orthopedic traumatic injury. So it's really quite substantial. And then they looked at kind of what percent of these large, alarming amount of patients underwent treatment. And using various surveys, they found that really less than 15% of patients use any mental health services at the two-year mark. And I think that's pretty substantial to show that a large amount of people are getting affected, and really we're not guiding them to the proper non-medical personnel to help them with their issues.
Yeah, I just want to round back and make sure that everyone knows that Matthew was in no way incentivized or encouraged to reference the Academy's clinical practice guidelines. However, we always do want to make sure that we endorse those as well, as it's certainly another resource the Academy provides, but we appreciate the plug, Matt. You say it really well that it is much more prevalent than we realize. And I think it's kind of a no-brainer. I think most people who are listening to this who take care of musculoskeletal trauma patients will say, you know, yeah, we know that they have psychosocial issues, right? But if you could just kind of enlighten us on what you found as far as the types of things that you find, because I found myself, as I read the article, more drawn to this idea of catastrophic thinking that you talked about, you know, because we say we know, but we understand the concept of PTSD. We understand the concept of depression and anxiety and chronic pain and how these lead to issues down the road. But I found the catastrophic thinking concept really fascinating and tried to wrap my head around it. But if you could just talk to us a little bit about the types of psychosocial issues that we see that present after these traumas and kind of how we start to see those present themselves in the post-operative period.
Yes, I think with regards to catastrophic thinking, things like pain anxiety, things like avoidance, we start to see these patients who, you know, sustain a trauma. They really weren't expecting it. They potentially can't attend to their job. They don't have any social support. They don't have family to help them. You know, maybe whether it be even walking on one leg with crutches for a while might be disruptive to their life. And so they get in this kind of cycle of avoidance where even doing the post-operative or, you know, post-fracture rehabilitation becomes quite a burden. And so I think that's probably a large component of why some of these patients do poorly, is just because they're not able to rehabilitate as well as someone who may have had better coping skills and better self-efficacy.
Yeah, I think we see this pretty commonly, right? Which is that it's not so much that the psychosocial hurdles that we're talking about encountering are separate from the orthopedic issue, in that they can really become a barrier to, you know, them improving from any standpoint, whether it's, you know, emotionally or psychosocially or, you know, from a musculoskeletal standpoint. That's really good insight you provide. So could you just talk to us a little bit also about kind of, in general, the effect that we see of these psychosocial issues and how they affect chronic pain? I think that was another really important thing. We know that there is obvious connections here between the opioid epidemic that we see and the psychosocial issues. And, you know, we talk about socioeconomic things putting people at risk for psychosocial issues. Well, you know, we've talked about the opioid epidemic on this podcast specifically last year, and we continue to address it with the Academy and different initiatives. But we know that these psychosocial issues also increase the risk of these patients becoming dependent on medications and even illicit drugs moving forward. If you could just talk about the effect of these psychosocial issues on chronic pain.
Yeah, definitely. So we actually originally had a section of opioid use disorders in this paper when we originally drafted it. But in reality, you know, opioid use disorders and the opioid epidemic in this country is a full review article in itself outside the scope of this paper. So there's too much literature to review in just this paper. So we got rid of it. But I think because of that, this section is one of the more difficult topics to tackle in a short amount of time. But I think the takeaway point is that the data really shows that early pain measurement can predict long-term disability and subsequent development of chronic pain. So clearly, early successful management of patients' pain is of the utmost importance. It's just, how do we do so? I think suffice it to say, a multidisciplinary, multimodal, individualized pain management approach should be considered with these patients to help control early pain. And then kind of toward the end of this section, I included one of the first questionnaires that I bring up in the paper, which is the SPOC questionnaire. It's basically a 27-item instrument. It covers somatic complaints, coping, patients' energy levels, and optimism. And it's been validated in samples of consecutive tibia fracture patients. It's highly predictive of functional outcomes 1 year after surgical fixation. At 6 weeks post-surgery, it accounted for almost 20% of the variation in patient-reported physical and mental function. And it was also strongly predictive of employment status at 1 year. So really, you gain a lot of stuff from just this one questionnaire that can be easily administered in the inpatient setting, in the office setting. And so at the end of the document as a whole, I've included about 10 different surveys and tools that can be used in both inpatient and office setting, because really the goal of all this is to find some validated tools that are time efficient and successful at predicting, you know, which patients are at risk of developing problems or are already experiencing problems. And going back to your original question, you know, everyone's going to experience some form of pain after an injury or after surgery. And everyone here can anecdotally attest to the fact that some people are just better at controlling their pain or enduring pain. And some patients have a really difficult time. So finding out which those patients are early on could hopefully drop down that number of long-term chronic pain patients who will subsequently potentially develop, you know, an opioid use disorder, given the way most pain management has been going these days.
Yeah, I think pain is one of these things that we don't really understand, maybe even as well as we think we do. And so I really appreciate this idea that you guys are coming at it from a different angle, right? Which is, hey, let's control pain, but at the same time, let's identify these factors that are associated with people who have pain control issues, and let's maybe get to the real root of the problem instead of, you know, putting a medicinal Band-Aid on the post-op pain and not addressing the real, you know, deeper lying issues. I think that's great. I also want to hit one more point, because I love the transition to the questionnaires, because that's where I'm going next. But I want to go at it this way. Do you think that in a musculoskeletal trauma population, these screening tools that we talk about using, and I want to get to this as well, but do you think these screening tools that we use to look for things like PTSD or depression, anxiety, stress disorders, do you think that the patients who struggle with early pain are the people we should target with these questionnaires to help prevent these psychosocial issues? Or do you think this is something that all musculoskeletal trauma patients should be screened for?
I think probably it's going to fall into the category of someone larger than just the letter showing signs of early pain, because I think, like the paper demonstrates, that there's a bit of a bidirectional relationship between pain and then all of these various psychosocial conditions. Both people with sleep dysfunction, elevated levels of depression, anxiety, they were strong predictors also of having chronic pain later, aside from just having early pain. So, and then also chronic pain has been predicted by, you know, anxiety, PTSD, catastrophic thinking, things other than just age, sex, occupation, type of injury, injury severity. So I think if you just focused on the pain, you'd miss out on a large group of patients that should have probably also been screened for, you know, anxiety, depression, PTSD, because they're also going to go on to potentially have chronic pain issues. So I'd say it's probably better to look at the whole general population. And obviously, that seems like a large burden to screen every single patient that comes through the door. And that's probably unrealistic, but increasing the amount of people that get screened at all would be beneficial.
Exactly. And we call it screening for a reason, right? We're screening entire populations to find these people. You mentioned the one questionnaire before. I imagine that many of the people listening to this either specialize in trauma or take care of patients on call that they have to follow who have been through big trauma. What other tools can we be using that are feasible within a busy office to screen these patients that are available? I know you referenced some of them in the paper, but if you could just mention a few for the listeners.
Well, some of the things that are in the paper, I think, are helpful, but there's other options that, you know, that I didn't necessarily write about, but things like, you know, 20-page self-help books or 1-minute relaxation therapy exercises or, you know, certain meditation and mindfulness training, things like that, that people can do on their own, given a pamphlet even, to learn how to do it for a minute of their day that have had, you know, positive results in the literature. I think something that I think would be very helpful is, you know, we've seen with elderly hip fractures that a geriatric co-management team leads to improved outcomes. And, you know, that's always on the boards. And so why not have a psychiatric co-management service for trauma patients? So start at time zero when they enter the hospital, have social workers engage in setting up outpatient follow-up with the appropriate individuals. And I'm pretty certain you'd see functional outcome scores increase. You probably see quality of life and happiness metrics go up, and ultimately a higher percent of patients, you know, getting back to their normal lives. I think compared to the number of patients who sustain trauma, there isn't as large of a network of well-trained psychologists, psychiatrists, and therapists who have received specialized training in PTSD. But in the current era of COVID, the majority of providers have pivoted to the digital arena. So using teletherapy would allow for a larger outreach despite the mismatch in providers.
You took the words right out of my mouth, because I think at our center here in Greenville, South Carolina, we really have, I think, been one of the leading centers as far as pushing bone health and a bone health team in fracture patients, specifically osteoporosis patients. But we know that within our system, we have a shortage of mental health providers. But I think you brought up my exact point, which is hopefully if we've learned anything from the pandemic, it's been that we can extend telemedicine services, not only within the orthopedic realm, but obviously, you know, psychosocial services have been one of the areas that have benefited from the growth of telehealth. I think that that is certainly a fantastic idea to be able to use that within the orthopedic trauma realm. So I know we're running a little short on time here. I'm enjoying discussing this. If you could just take the last few minutes and talk to us a little bit about intervention. So obviously we're not psychiatrists, we're not psychologists. You mentioned some of the mindfulness apps and things. I personally use one of those myself, and I know people who have used it for pain control, and I think it can be great as a recommendation. But if you can just talk about some things that we can do as orthopedists to help, you know, embattle some of these psychosocial issues, but also ways that we can refer patients to get them to the right place once we find these patients and identify them who are at risk, and ways that we can really help these patients to improve their outcomes moving forward.
Sure. And I think you brought up a good point that it's not going to be on us as orthopedic surgeons to be the ones giving the treatment to these patients. But, you know, we can certainly help diagnose it and certainly send them to the people who can help. And frequently, you know, these patients who undergo trauma often aren't really seeing any physicians. And maybe we're, as the orthopedists, are the first doctor they've seen in years. So we need to do our due diligence to kind of weed out the ones that are really at risk. And, you know, probably the easiest way is if a patient outright states, you know, they're depressed, they have anxiety, they're experiencing some difficulty doing rehab due to their injury, you know, they're living at home alone or have poor social support, or maybe even their chart indicates some of the clues that we talked about earlier, like they have a premorbid psych condition, a smoking history, lower education level, etc. Then those people, we can right away just refer them, give them some information on perhaps local psychologists or someone that can give them some help. And then the harder ones are the ones we don't know about, and so we've screened for them, let's say, or we finally sit down and talk to them and, you know, maybe just end the conversation with some empathic comment. I know this process is really difficult. If at any point you feel it becomes too overwhelming and you need some help, I'm always here to guide you in the right direction. And I think that's really the main job for us, is just to take a little bit of extra time to talk to the patients and see which ones need the help the most. As far as particular interventions go, I think a lot of it is stuff that needs new research. So, you know, we already know for decades that in terms of treating depression itself, you know, having SSRIs plus therapy is more effective than just therapy. So that could easily be something that a randomized trial could be done with orthopedics and gives therapy plus SSRIs to patients that have undergone trauma and look at functional outcome scores, return to work, etc. So I hope that that helps answer your question.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it really is important. If nothing else comes away from someone listening to this interview, I don't expect every person who's a practitioner who listens to us today to, you know, email you and get a questionnaire and start giving it to all their fracture patients. But the point you made right there at the end that I think is huge is, number one, awareness, right? So we just want to be aware that this exists. And I think most of us say, well, duh, yeah, trauma patients have these issues, but we need to know that it matters, right? It matters that we take care of these people. And also, you know, from a purely orthopedic standpoint, it affects their outcomes. So, you know, all the things that we do intra and postoperatively and preoperatively to prevent infection and get better reductions, it's because we care about outcomes. And so we know that this directly affects outcomes. So we should care. And I think that you make the point of just an empathic comment or, hey, if you are struggling with this, we can help you, or we can find someone to help you. Even that comment could potentially make a world of difference for a patient as a person and may not necessarily affect their femur or their humerus, and it may affect their outcome, but it affects that person on the whole. So Matt, I really appreciate you being with us today. I think that you certainly have a really interesting and cool background and a different point of view on this, which I think we need in the big tent of orthopedics. I think these different viewpoints allow us to be better at everything we do and provide better care for people. And it's been a really great interview. So thank you for being on with us today.
Yeah, thanks, Corey. Thanks again for having me. I definitely want to thank Dr. Kang and Dr. Perry and Dr. Moffrey for all their invaluable help on this article as well. And I hope everyone kind of reads the details of it and sees if they can use any of the information to help their practice and help their patients.
Absolutely. And I also wanted to take the last few seconds here and say that I know we have a lot of trainees and medical students even and residents and fellows who listen to us. And I just want to take this last couple seconds and just bring to light that, you know, while we're talking about mental health, we're not just worried about the mental health of our patients as well. We're worried about the mental health of our colleagues. We know it's a completely separate discussion to talk about issues of burnout and depression and anxiety amongst even residents and fellows or medical students. But if you're one of these people, even someone who's out in practice and you're listening and you're struggling with some of these same issues, it's hard for us to help our patients unless we help ourselves first. So I hope that you'll be open-minded to that and just keep in mind that mental health matters just as much or more than orthopedic medicine. So Matt, thanks for being with us. I appreciate your time, and hopefully everyone will enjoy it. I know I've enjoyed talking with you.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
So our first article we're going to review this month is titled Preoperative Opioid Use Increases the Cost of Care in Total Joint Arthroplasty. This is from Dr. Carrie Bell and colleagues. And I think there's a couple important points we have to understand before we really dive into this article. The first of which is that the predictors of financial cost related to total joint arthroplasty have become much more important in recent years as we've shifted from a fee-for-service model to more of the bundle model, which I think probably everyone listening to this podcast is familiar with. And so if we have a set number of dollars to take care of these arthroplasty patients, how we allocate each dollar as well as preventing complications becomes much, much more important as we are basically telling the payers that we can provide a certain quality of service for a certain price. Therefore, we have to identify and hopefully eliminate the outliers. So the other important point that we have to discuss is that we've started to identify, as we've done large database studies as well as randomized controlled trials within the arthroplasty population, things that can preoperatively tip us off to a patient that may be one of these outliers. We know about body mass index, smoking status, and hemoglobin A1C in diabetics. However, recent research has shown that preoperative opioid use can put our arthroplasty patients at risk for increased rates of complications as well as poor patient-reported outcomes. Therefore, these patients are just as likely as any to be these cost outliers. So this is a really interesting study that I'm not sure has been done before, looking at how preoperative opioid use doesn't just affect outcomes, but also affects the cost of care in total joint arthroplasty. So this was a retrospective study done over a three-year period looking at Medicare patients who underwent elective unilateral primary total knee or hip arthroplasty. They looked at their preoperative opioid usage as well as comorbidities, and then their length of stay and demographic information. Patients were then grouped based on their preoperative opioid usage, and costs were compared between groups. Then multivariate linear regression analyses were performed to analyze whether preoperative opioid usage influenced the cost of total joint arthroplasty care. Over 3,000 patients were included in the study, and of those 3,211 patients, 569 of those, which was around 18%, used preoperative opioids. Of those, 43% of those patients only used tramadol preoperatively. What the authors found were that costs associated with these patients' care were significantly higher for opioid and tramadol users, significantly in the range of just over $19,000 for preoperative opioid users compared to $17,572 for non-opioid users, which was statistically significant. Interestingly, they also found that length of stay was significantly longer for preoperative opioid users, and total post-acute care costs were increased by 70% for opioid users and 48% for tramadol users compared to those that were opioid naive. Most importantly to the bundle, perhaps, is that patients that had preoperative opioid use were much more likely to be discharged to a skilled nursing facility than to home. which we know can put a huge dent in our bundle cost. So what this study demonstrated that I think is a novel study within our field, even though it may be a well-understood concept, is that preoperative opioid usage was associated with higher cost of care in total joint arthroplasty. So as we treat these patients preoperatively or get them ready for surgery, limiting or completely restricting preoperative opioid use for pain management can not only decrease their risk for complications, but can also decrease their cost of care, making it more cost efficient for the entire system. The next article that we'll discuss is from the April 15th edition of the Yellow Journal titled Deltoid Ligament Injuries Associated with Ankle Fractures, Arguments For and Against Direct Repair. This is from Dr. Jesse Doty and his colleagues. We will briefly discuss this article today. However, I will point specifically trainees as well as anyone who takes care of ankle fractures back to this article, as they do a really awesome job reviewing the critical literature related to ankle fractures and deltoid ligament repair that has come out even over the past 30 years. And the way I'll summarize this article is really what they put in their discussion, which is stating that most of the evidence that suggests that we should not repair the deltoid ligament, despite some medial clear space widening on the medial side of the ankle after repair of an ankle fracture, is based on older literature from the 1980s and 1990s. These studies suggest that patients who did not have a direct ligament repair did relatively well. However, upon the authors going back and doing a detailed evaluation of the studies, they found that the same study groups had unsatisfactory outcomes in up to 30% of the patients based on our current treatment standards. In many of these studies, we're using non-validated measures to evaluate the patients postoperatively. They also found that functional outcomes seem to be less predictable than stated without a ligament repair medially, and that long-term ankle mortise stability was oftentimes compromised, as well as the parameters radiographically that we accepted in some of these studies from the 1980s and 90s that lead us to believe that we do not need to repair the deltoid ligament may alter our tibio-talar contact and force contact at the ankle, which may put the patients at increased risk for post-traumatic arthritis. The authors do a really great job making an argument, really using the literature for and against repair of the ligament. However, they do give a compelling argument based on more recent literature using more up-to-date and current treatment standards that ligament repair may be indicated in many more cases than we realize. I'll steal a phrase from the discussion portion of the article, where at the end of the article, the authors say, based on the available literature, indications to do a deltoid repair include medial gutter fracture fragmentation, precluding talus reduction, persistent dynamic widening of the medial clear space despite lateral column fixation, high energy rotational ankle injuries in athletes or patients who want to maintain active lifestyles, and Weber C ankle fractures. This is based on the more recent literature that they reviewed in the argument for repair of the deltoid ligament. Ultimately, my takeaway from this article is that deltoid ligament repair may not be indicated. However, I think that this population is much smaller than we previously thought and is mostly made up of potentially older or low activity level individuals who are not looking to return to a high level of activity. However, particularly in athletes, and those who are looking for a high level of activity postoperatively, as well as those who have some medial gutter fracture fragmentation that may keep us from closing down our medial clear space, as well as Weber C ankle fractures based on current literature, it is worth the slight additional increased operative time and the incision to repair the ankle ligaments to not only restore stability and ankle motion, but also hopefully prevent post-traumatic arthritis. Overall, this was a really well-written article, and specifically, I want to refer the readers back to the actual article, to the tables, which the authors included, where they talk about pros and cons of repair versus non-repair, and then also talking about the literature that exists and the conclusions and the critique of each of these articles making an argument for and against deltoid ligament repair. However, I think the authors do make a compelling argument that perhaps deltoid ligament repair should be much more prevalent, particularly in younger active individuals, than it is currently. The last article that we'll discuss this month is from the April 15th edition of the Yellow Journal from Dr. David Langerhusen and colleagues titled Analysis of Online Reviews of Orthopedic Surgeons and orthopedic practices using natural language processing. So I think over the past few years, we've really moved into this realm where we not only care about the x-ray or the post-operative range of motion, but we really, using patient-reported outcomes, are starting to look at what is the patient doing post-operatively, how are they doing, and then now we're moving into this realm of the patient experience, which I put in air quotes, because we're not really exactly sure what that means sometimes. However, I think this article really is helping us to understand what the patient experience consists of and how the patients view this kind of abstract concept. So the way they did this is they went back and looked on Yelp.com and they collected over 11,000 free text reviews with a 1 to 5 star rating of orthopedic surgeons. They then used this really cool natural language processing as well as IBM's Watson Tone Analyzer to look at the most frequently occurring word combinations among different rating categories from 1 to 5 stars. They also looked at themes within these word combinations as well as dominant tones, which were analyzed by IBM's Watson, of emotional and language styles, and then looked for trends among these ratings and this different type of language to see how they trended together. So what they found was that for individual surgeons and orthopedic offices, the themes that seemed to matter the most were logistics, such as waiting time, organization, and how the front office staff handle patients, care and compassion, particularly from the surgeon, trust, meaning can the patient trust the surgeon, how highly recommended they were, and then customer service varying among different rated categories. The three word combinations I feel were probably the most interesting part of this study, which were put into some tables throughout the article, which we'll direct the readers back to in the April 15th edition of the Yellow Journal. And again, I think that we find that some of the three word combinations used to describe the individual surgeons in the care and compassion category amongst the 1 star or the poor reviews were poor bedside manner, worst experienced doctor, horrible bedside manner, compared to in the 5 star ratings, took time explain, wonderful bedside manner, and took time answer. When it comes to customer service, the word combinations amongst the 1 star ratings were things like office staff rude, called office told, doctor office staff, compared to the 5 star ratings, which were staff friendly helpful, office staff friendly. Another interesting point of the article was that the tone analyzer found that amongst negative reviews, the two dominant tones were anger and sadness, which were seen to be statistically significant with trends. And then amongst positive reviews, the statistically significant trends were with the tones of joy and confidence. When we look at the three-word combinations looking at orthopedic offices and not specifically the surgeon, I think we find very similar three-word combinations talking about care and compassion. However, the ones that are different are logistics, where patients that gave negative reviews said long wait time, appointment waited hour, or waiting room hour. However, when they talk about customer service in positive reviews, they say office staff was friendly and the staff was friendly and helpful. So I think this article, while really well done and really cool to me, is really starting to scratch the surface of us understanding the, again, air quote, patient experience. And I think that this, maybe it's intuitive to think that the logistical aspect of the patient visit and how caring we are matters to the patient, but I think that this really backs up the fact that maybe it matters even more than we think it does, and that maybe people don't care quite as much as if we get an anatomical reduction of their fracture as they do that we take care of them in a way that tells them that we value them and we value their time. So again, just something else that we can put in our pocket to remember as we organize our offices and take care of patients, to remember that ultimately the things the patients remember may not be how much they hurt after surgery so much as how long they had to wait to see the physician and how caring and trust inspiring the physician was. Well, that is all we have for you this month. Again, we want to thank Dr. Seminero for coming on and spending some time with us today, as well as all of our other authors who contributed to the April 1st and 15th edition of the Yellow Journal. We hope that wherever you are, you're starting to see some warm spring weather and you'll be able to get outside and enjoy it. And then also as these patients who crash their bikes and fall off of roofs or whatever they're doing come to you, that you'll keep some of this stuff in mind and remember that we're treating the whole patient and not just the injury. So hopefully see everyone next month, and everyone take care.